Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to another special edition of the Supertone Show.
Brothers and sisters, David Bowie, and The Next Day, which was the title track from his 24th and penultimate studio album, announced and released on his 66th birthday, which was on the 8th of March in 2013, and released on his ISO Records label via exclusive license to Columbia Records. And it was his first album of new material in 10 years, because everybody thought he'd retired. Shock.
It was a shock when it came, because nobody knew anything about it, did they? And all of a sudden, it just came out. It wasn't pre-announced or anything. It just happened. And I remember listening to it, and we ordered it immediately, didn't we?
We did, didn't we? Yeah.
And on vinyl, and we were blown away. I think it's a great record. The video...
Oh, it's stunning.
It is stunning, yeah. It is stunning. Gary Oldman.
Marianne Cotillard.
Oh, blimey, I do.
Well, get you, Mme Cherie. I know her name.
But, of course, this little series of shows that we're doing is nothing to do, actually, with David Bowie, but the guitar players who've played with him.
Indeed.
And And this is a bit of a change for him, because on here there was David Thorne.
Yes.
And also Jerry Leonard. Now, yes. I don't really know an awful lot about these guys. They just sort of popped up out of nowhere. And, you know, being steeped in the 70s and 80s and 90s and stuff, I was used to hearing, you know, Carl Kalamar or Ronson or all these other guitar players I've had on.
Yeah.
And these guys rock up. And I've got to say, they did a marvellous job in creating... If you listen to that, there's an awful lot that's going on guitar-wise.
Yeah, and you don't realise, do you?
No. And but when you listen to it on cans, you really, really hear the complexity of what's going on. I mean, there's the classic bowing... It sounds like somebody's yeah. being strangled in the background.
That's David Thorne, yeah.
And that's what, yeah, and it sounds it's a bit Fripp like, and in fact Jerry Leonard has been sort of mentioned in the same sentence as Fripp, hasn't he?
Yeah,
you
know? It's crazy. David Bowie is also playing electric guitar on that track as well.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So the thing is, right. So we've got these two guitar players, and it's David Thorne, okay, he looks like the Mad Professor from Back to the Future.
He does.
He's like he's put his fingers in the sockets and his head just goes bang. And they call him Dr. Ambient, and he's an American. I thought you might like
Dr.
that.
Dr. Ambient, that's great. Who doesn't want to be called Dr. Ambient, you know? Wow, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you like that. That tickled me as well when I read it.
Great.
So he's an American guy. He's a composer and producer as well. And he's known for combining electronic and acoustic instruments and for the use of looping.
Mm.
And he studied with Leonard Bernstein, which I didn't know about. And he's worked with loads of people like Jeff Beck, John Legend, Madonna, K.D. Lang, David Sylvian, Tori Amos. And you'll love this. He's actually a big... musician and film composer, and he worked on the music for A Knight's Tale.
No.
Your favourite movie.
Well, it's one of them, certainly. Yeah, I mean, that's the one that goes...
That's the
blind father. Yeah, the blind father, when he rocks up, it brings tears every time. I love that film.
So it is great. So when Thorne rocks up to the studio, he brings them like a 16-space rack of some heavy-duty effects and cooks up loops on the spot. So basically, and he uses them in a rock context with loads of ambient sounds, bending his tremolo arm, which is that sort of bar on the
guitar.
Known
as the wang.
Mm. So that's him, and he's also got this other sort of side project called Splattercell, and he just does some crazy shit basically. So that's David Thorne. So we've got him, and then we've got Jerry Leonard, who was Bowie's last musical director, and he's from Dublin.
Mm.
And he started off as a tape operator in Dublin's Lombard Sound Studios. And guess what? He recorded the demo tape for a 16-year-old Sinead O'Connor.
No.
How cool is that?
Wow.
So exciting that. So he studied classical guitar as well for 5 years at the Municipal College of Music in Dublin. And he met Bowie through a guy called Mark Palati, who's a producer and musician. And Jerry worked on a track for the abandoned album that I didn't even know anything about this. There was an album called Toy that he was working on in 2001.
Okay.
And he abandoned it. And Jerry first performed live with Bowie at the Rosen Ballroom Theatre in 2002. And they played both the albums Heathen and Low in their entirety. So, and he's the only guy who's got original writing credits other than David Bowie on The Next Day.
But I didn't know that either.
Yeah, so he helped write Boss of Me and I'll Take You There.
Blimey.
And this guy's another musician in his own right, played with Laurie Anderson, Cyndi Lauper. I love Laurie Anderson. Don't always understand her, but I just love her. Cyndi Lauper, Suzanne Vega, Rufus Wainwright. And they say he kind of adds this Celtic yearning to his playing. So yeah. You've got this fusion of these guys.
Well, we saw a little clip from him playing with Suzanne Vega in The Isle of Man, didn't we? He was on at the Gaiety, whatever.
Wow.
You know? Amazing.
Yeah.
You know?
So that album and that song, I mean, it's, and I think that the video, I mean, it got banned on YouTube and then they reinstated it because it was just, it absolutely ruffled feathers.
Well, Bowie gets crucified at the end and it's full of rampant Catholicism, isn't
it? Well, there's a stigmata thing, and at the end he just, because Marion's sort of bleeding and stuff, and there's references about St. Lucy or something serving the eyes on the plate, and he just says at the end, thank you, Gary. Thank you, Marion. Thank you, everybody. Goodbye. And he disappears like Bilbo Baggins. Bang.
Wow.
Ka-ching.
squad and we're coming to town. Beep, beep.
David Bowie, Fashion, from his 14th studio album, Scary Monsters and Supercroups, which was released on the 12th September 1980 on RCA Records. It was also released as a second single from the album, where it went to number 5 in the UK charts, number 70 in the US.
I know.
Oh, those Americans, you see. The album went to number 1 in the UK and 12 in the United States. But is this the second or third track we've had off Scary Monsters in these two shows we've done about David Bowie's guitar players? Well, you know why? I love Robert Fripp. He's just the best. And this band is the band. It's Visconti producing, right?
Yep.
And if I would urge you to listen to this on headphones, because about halfway through you get some lovely little clinky percussion. It's on the left-hand side and it's going tick-tick-tick-tick-tick-tick-tick. It's absolutely wonderful, just in the background, gorgeous. But it's Carlos Alomar doing the dig, 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 dig. Great.
Like a rhythm.
It's Robert Fripp doing the... Now, that solo, where did it come from? Where did that solo... But you know exactly who it is. And it is probably one of the most distinctive solos that on any of Bowie's records. You know, even more distinctive than Ronno's. Because within 1 second, if you get on a dance floor or whatever, within it can just be on for a microsecond and you can hear it. It's that fuzz. It's strangling it, that guitar. And where those notes come from, God only knows. Well, you know, it's unbelievable because, you know, it's like,
it's mad. It's bonkers, mad, isn't it? It felt like there was a Smash Monster in there, one of those little metal alien heads, you know? Or like R2-D2, you know, falling
well, Smash Monsters were great.
Trash mashers or something.
One of the greatest ads of all time, wasn't it?
It is, that? Isn't it? And they hit them. They smashed them.
Yeah. They hit them with their metal knives. And then they smashed them all to bits. Now, for people in America and everybody else, they probably won't get this because they didn't see the ad on British TV. But it was in the 80s, wasn't it? 70s.
Yeah. It was basically some sort of robot. So they were all sort of like disc heads, you know, like a round sphere that just like an oval, isn't it? They'd been like, and they had these little eyes and stuff. And they were on board their family ship, and they were talking about, you know, the instant mashed potato. And they were just thinking, well, why would people eat like vegetable potatoes when you've got Smash?
Yeah.
So it was, yeah.
Completely. No,
it was
completely,
just
yeah.
So endearing. In fact, we've got a photo of them on the wall.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yes, carry on.
Back to fashion.
Yeah, well, I'm a bit sort of gobsmacked with that song because, again, when you listen to it intently, there's so many different layers to it. And in fact, when I did the research, you know, I came across like this David Bowie kind of encyclopedia website. And I've actually seen the lyric sheet that he wrote for fashion. And it's incredible just to see where he's crossed off.
Admit it, what's on the wall behind you?
The lyrics too.
What is pinned to the wall behind you?
Yeah,
I can see it.
I'm fascinated by it, yeah.
It's
yeah,
amazing.
So it's David Bowie's like actual, you know, writing. It was on the internet. So I just wanted to, because what it does is it humanizes him, you know, and he's a person. And I know that people go, oh my God, you know, he's a genius and all that. But at the end of the day, in the beginning of the day, he was a real person and he needed human things like love and you know, family time and to be creative and all that kind of thing. And so that to me reminds me that he was a songwriter as well. That he worked really hard.
He did,
and
he was a
songwriter.
Very inspirational. But to work with a team like this, though, because again, it's my favourite rhythm section. George Murray and Dennis Davis on this.
Oh, they call it the Damn Trio, which I didn't know about. But apparently, that's the last time that they had this kind of magic sort of trio.
Yeah,
that they all worked together on that.
But remarkable. It's a remarkable record. And still stands up today, doesn't it? Really,
it's crazy. You know? And I didn't realise as well that I'd forgotten that they'd recorded at the Power Station. Mm. And that I didn't know, was owned by a cousin of John Bon Jovi called Tony Bon Jovi.
No.
Indeed.
Oh.
Yeah, who used to work at Motown. And he got a job at Motown because he wrote to them and he guessed through just listening to the size of their reverb echo chamber by just listening to the delay on the recordings. And he wrote to them and said, and told them what the dimensions of the room that he thought they had. Yeah, their reverb room. And they gave him a job because of it, because he was complete geekhead.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, tell me something else which I didn't know because I've just seen in the notes.
I've just had a glance.
But go on, tell me about it.
Well, so what you don't realise about Motown is that when he got there, there were more secrets as well, because obviously this echo room was a bit of a secret. But when they had a thing called a Pultec tube valve equalizer on every input going into their 24-track machines and on every output going out of their machines. So what does that mean? What's that translate, a Pultec tube valve equalizer?
Well, it's basically like a glorified tone control, right?
Right.
But the valves, so that they add some coloration to the sound, and you always get a little bit of compression with a valve when you're putting stuff through it, generally speaking, when you push it. So the more level you push through it, and it colors the sound in a very pleasant way.
Right.
That's why most electric guitar players use valve amps, because valve amps give a pleasant sound. You use a valve amp, of course, because it gives you a very pleasant,
I wouldn't say
your tone is pleasant, it's extreme, it's like somebody tearing your head off.
It's responsive and it does feel organic, it does feel like it connects, it doesn't feel metal or digital or sanitized or sterilized, basically.
Yeah.
So do you think that helped give Motown its sound?
Well, obviously, because I didn't know about it.
No.
And you know, and it's difficult to tell because of the combination of equipment everybody used, because you don't know what compressor, you have no idea, but that kind to make sense, you know, but it's a very expensive thing to do.
Well, they were saying as well that they only usually get like six in a studio, but to have 24, so you'd have 48 of those bananas in each studio. That's cooking on gas.
It certainly is. It's amazing. Well, you know, but I mean, just going back to these guitar players, splendid stuff, inspirational, as is this next one.
Time takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth. You pull on your finger, then another finger, then cigarette. The water wall is calling, it lingers, then you forget. Oh, 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 you're a rock and roll suicide. You're too old to lose it, too young to choose it. And the clock waits so patiently on your song. You walk past the cafe, but you don't eat when you've lived too long. Oh no, 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 you're a rock and roll suicide. Shift break the snarling as you stumble across the road, but the day breaks instead, so you hurry home. Don't let the sun blast your shadow, don't let the milk float rob your mind. They're so natural, religiously unkind. Oh no, love, you're not alone. You're watching yourself, but you're too unfair.
David Bowie and Rock and Roll Suicide. That was originally released as the closing track on his fifth studio album, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. And that was on the 16th of June in 1972 on the RCA record label.
And that last chord and that last note is nothing to do about The Day in the Life by the Beatles, which of course was released in 1967. Nothing to do with that. Of course, that one is harmonically more complicated, the Beatles one, and this is just basically a load of cellos sort of doing a meh, but it tips, nods the hat, or tips the hat, tips the cap, I don't know.
This one was 1972.
Indeed. But, of course, on this is Mick Ronson.
Ronno.
Now, you know, one of my other... I do like Mick Ronson, because I not don't just like his playing, but I like him... He was a groovy sort of guy who's from Hull. We talked about him on the last show. But the reason why I wanted to put this in today was he wasn't just a guitar player. I mean, this is a lovely, some lovely parts. You know, there's a lovely little tremolo guitar in there, some sort of, that sounds like it's a Fender amp with trem on, it sounds like. And that's what he used to use in the early days, isn't
it? Yeah, set to 10, apparently, with his Crybaby wah pedal.
Yeah, that was Marshall's later on, I think.
That's right. Yeah, the Marshall's later on. But he said that it basically, the gear is so much, but it's really just your fingers and your personality.
That's right, yeah. And he just used to turn everything up. And, I mean, there's that story of him when he actually played on Gene Genie, and apparently Bowie didn't like doing too many takes, and he heard the song, they played it through twice, and the third take is the one that is actually on the record. Yeah. And You know it is, because there's bits where, like, because we've actually played this, haven't we?
And, oh, yeah, and it's not consistent.
No, there's a little bit more of a verse in certain bits, yeah. And a bit the chorus comes in at a different time. And they're obviously just winging it.
I know, but it gives it... I mean, it was a bit of a bugger to learn, actually, but it was a good exercise in just sort of, you know, stretching your wings and just seeing what other musicians actually
we kind of did that, because obviously we did it for fun when we were on the Isle of Man, and as working musicians, of course, we were earning a bit of money, which is all good, but also it really extended you as a bass player, because what we didn't really think too much about the songs that we were doing from an audience's point of view. We're doing stuff that we really like.
And
stuff
really that, blinking difficult.
Yeah,
as
stuff
well,
that
actually.
Stretch you and me, for that matter, because I've never really learned some of these parts before, these classic songs.
But it's like putting the moccasins on of a great shoemaker or something, you know, you need to actually walk in their shoes and you learn these songs and then they take on like a different shape, and then when you've got a load of drunk people in front of you, it takes on a different shape yet again. And it's, you know, it's been quite an it's been quite a humbling and beautiful experience, actually, because it's not something I would ever do, but I've learned so much in terms of where the bass can go. I really, really love it.
Yeah, and it was good, you know, because you never went through that sort of tutelage that I went through of that jamming thing and then playing in bands, then doing sessions and stuff. You've just jumped into playing bass, you know, and you're in a band and you're a rock and roll band and you're off, you know what I mean? You haven't got time to...
Well, I've had people sort of like trying to hand me ashtrays on stage. standing there with pints on their heads and stuff, and just like, and guys going, I love your glasses, and just like really odd things, and people trying to jump on stage and grab mics all the time.
We've had inflatable penguins, we've had people turning up like Christmas cakes, we've had everything.
It is.
But back to...
Yes, now...
This track.
Now, I love this, right, because what's quite interesting, and what I didn't realise, but I didn't know that Ken Scott didn't particularly like cymbals, so what's unusual about this album is that there's acoustic guitar on every track.
Right.
And that what he was using was that the treble of the acoustic and the sort of the percussiveness of the acoustic strumming, and putting that high in the mix to give it sort of the same as if it was a hi-hat or a cymbal. Yeah, so into cymbals. So that was quite... And when you listen out for it, you go, oh, yeah.
It's that's like, great. Yeah, well, I didn't know that either.
No.
I've read the book. I've read the Ken Scott book. It's a great book, incidentally.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that Ronno, he actually arranged all the strings on this, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And what he used to say, and this is lovely, right? So this is Ken Scott, the engineer. He worked with the Beatles as well, He said, Ronno's contribution to not only Ziggy, but every Bowie album that he worked on was major. And did I mention major? I love that, though. He was a great guitarist, a great arranger, and a great down-to-earth guy. He knew exactly what was needed at exactly the right time, and neither David or he would have achieved anywhere near the success without him. And sometimes before a session, he'd have to go... He'd run upstairs and lock himself in the toilet to write the string arrangements, and he'd turn up to a session just before a session, grinning, 10 minutes later, going, I got it.
Wow.
So he was just phenomenal with his skill. I mean, this guy was just beautiful.
Teddy.
David Bowie, Valentine's Day, the fourth single from his 24th and penultimate studio album, The Next Day, released on the 8th of March in 2013 on the ISO record label. Bass was played by Tony Visconti, so going right back to his roots.
It's funny that, isn't it?
Yeah. Sterling Campbell on drums.
Yep.
Right? And on guitar. The reason why I picked this is Earl Slick. We haven't heard a lot of Earl so
no,
far, and he plays a lot with Bowie live.
Yep.
And this is classic Slick, that great big, great intro. Down, 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 down. Real, what a great
He's
sound.
He's got real attitude, isn't he, this guy?
Licks all the way through it. Absolutely beautiful. This is a great rock and roll record. It really is a great rock and roll. And check out the reverb on those drums at the beginning. Oh. And this was this actually recorded at the Magic Shop? It was, wasn't it? Because it was done under complete secrecy because, as we said it before about this album, nobody knew it was coming out.
Yeah.
And the Magic Shop had this amazing, it's sadly closed now because property developers, again, have redeveloped the building, so they had to close down.
Yeah.
And the rents went up and they actually, that's it, terrible. Absolutely terrible because a studio of that quality, you know, ended up, anyway, the Neve recording console added a lot to the sound of that. A great, big, fat, warm, beautiful sound. Visconti doing what he did well. Bowie, right back to his songwriting greatness, you know. Because
yeah.
This is one of my favourite tracks on the album, actually.
Yeah.
So talk to me about Earl.
Well, Earl Slick, born Frank Mandaloni. Mandaloni.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mandaloni. Anyway, he was born in Brooklyn, New York. And is best known for his collaborations with David and John Lennon, would you believe, and Yoko and Robert Smith from
The Cure.
That's
right. And funnily enough, of course, Reeves Gabriel, who
of
was
course,
in, is now in The Cure.
In The Cure.
Yeah.
Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah, so why
really
are they actually... Anyway.
So Slick was initially hired by Bowie to replace Mick Ronson as lead guitarist for the Diamond Dogs tour in 1974. Mm. So... he basically played lead guitar on his Young Americans and Station to Station albums. That was in 1975 and 76. But now there's a little bit of history here with Bowie's management because there are quite a few stories of musicians falling out with his management and not going on various tours.
Mm.
And I did read about one management, and I don't know the names now. They basically were whispering. I think they were doing that to Ron as well. Well, they were whispering, telling David one story, and I think Slick another story. And they were lying to them. They were trying to get them to fall out.
Well...
And it's only when certain members, when David Bowie met up with people later on, that they sat down over dinner and started talking again, that they realised he'd been set up.
Hmm.
And, oh, I tell you, that makes me so cross.
It makes your blood boil.
It does, doesn't it?
Boil.
Because what the are they doing with these people? And it's just not acceptable. It's totally unacceptable. So Slick, he's got a 1968 Gibson J45 guitar. He bought it from a mom and pop music store in 1970, and it's on every Bowie record that he played on.
Is that right?
Yeah, I thought you'd like a bit of trivia.
I like J45s, you know. That's one instrument that we don't have in our armoury because I sold mine. I had an SJ45 and God knows why I sold it, but I sold it.
Sometimes it's one in, one out, though, isn't it?
Well, it is one in, one out. I got another Collings instead. So we've got three Collings now, but no Gibsons, which we do need a Gibson, but that's on. It's on the list like anything else because they've got a certain distinctive sound. They sort of sit in a mix in a certain way.
Certain palette, certain colour, isn't
that's
it?
That's right, yeah. And they do sound great, but Earl Slick uses it to great effect, of course, on all his records.
And what was really good, though, is that Bowie loved the way he was on stage, that he didn't sort of kiss ass, basically, that he did his own thing. He didn't ask for permission. He was given free rein. He wouldn't be told what to do anyway. And so I think they had this kind of mutual working relationship. And he was saying that the great thing about working with Bowie was that if, you know, you could play a song 50, 100 times, but one day, one night, you'll forget something. You're just blank. Mm. We've had that.
Yeah.
And he said Bowie just laughed.
Yeah.
And it's the same as like when Bowie used to sing like second verse instead of the first verse or whatever. They just laugh at each other.
We know that happens a lot in the Starlight Campbell band. No
saying no
that.
Names, Mr. Simon Campbell. I've been there a few times with you. Just to conclude as well with Slick, you know what really went... he went up in my complete perception of Earl Sick, and he just said, you know, he used to be really good mates with Ronno, with Mick Ronson. He said, out of every guitar player that David ever had, I think Mick Ronson is better than all of us put together.
Listening to the Supertones Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Thank you, darling. And that was David Bowie again. And China Girl from his 15th studio album, Let's Dance. And that was released on the 14th of April 1983 on the EMI record label. Now, I didn't realise this. It was actually written by Iggy Pop and David Bowie during their years in Berlin.
Indeed.
And it first appeared on Pop's debut solo album, The Idiot. Great name for an album.
Indeed.
And that was back in 1977.
Absolutely.
What?
Well, the thing is who was playing on the original, the Iggy Pop version?
Oh, right.
My favourite rhythm section, Dennis Davis, George Merrick, Carlos Alomar.
Really?
David Bowie backing vocals, yeah. But this version, of course, was produced by...
Nile Rodgers.
Yeah. And the drum sound, I've got to say, for that this era, that drum sound, it's really nice. It's not just really nice, it's beautiful. It's Omar Hakim, who is... Well, again, one of my favourite.
You go on about
drummers.
Him, actually. He's one of these guys that you've introduced into my life, yeah. His name, actually.
He's an utterly genius player. Such groove, great tone, you know.
Do you know what? I think, actually, listening to, having done these shows enough now and having worked with bands now with drummers for the last few years, because obviously my folk background, we didn't have a drummer for years. And it's so incredible, the talent that people have. And the contribution that a beautiful, talented musician can bring to the recording of an album, of a song.
Yeah.
Because I know that it's the composer and it's Bowie's ideas, but also you can contribute your presence, your flavour, your style to that song and you become a part of that song. It's just, it's quite a magnificent creative process.
Well, this is my by far my favourite track off the Let's Dance album. Because I love his vocal. I think his vocal's very impassioned. I stumble into town like a sacred cow, you know, dreaming of swastikas in my head, you know. And when he goes down there, he's got such depth, and the whole thing starts to build until Stevie Ray Vaughan opens up. Now, you know...
The guitar player, by
well,
the way.
Yeah.
Stevie Holy, Ray Vaughan.
The guitar player.
The guitar
Holy
player.
Holy moly. What a player, because, you know, Niall's fiddling around with his funky stuff, which he's really good at, and it's a great sound. Yep. He's got all that, you know, all that going on the way through it, and that do-do-do-do-do-do, beautiful.
It
and
is.
Then he comes in, I can sing it. It's brilliant. A brilliant piece of guitar playing. And I think that David Bowie, well, he contributed massively to the introduction of Stevie Ray Vaughan to the world. Because this was massive album, wasn't it? And all of a sudden people, and including me, who is that on guitar? And then they said that this guy, and Bowie, I think he was quoted somewhere saying that this guy, he sort of dug him up from somewhere. And
he saw him at the Montreux Jazz Festival, apparently.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, back in 1982. And he said that he was completely floored by him. He said he hadn't been that excited about a guitar player since he saw Jeff Beck play with the Tridents, which was one of his first bands.
No.
Yeah, he was totally blown away with him. And he wanted somebody to play that kind of style, and Stevie Ray Vaughan was perfect.
Well, it's that sound. It's that Strat with the great big fat strings that are impossible to bend.
Well, what
but he
makes
did
him
it.
So special, because I know this guy, I know his name, and I listen to that track and I go, I know, but there's something different about him. There's something, why do people really go, oh my God, that's Stevie Ray Vaughan?
Well, what he did, I think he reintroduced electric guitar to blues, because there was a lot of stuff going on. And when you see him play and you hear him play, he was doing something quite different.
Okay.
And, you know, you listen to Hendrix and Steve Ray Vaughan does a lot of Hendrix covers over the years. You see him doing it. He does a great job of them.
Yeah.
But he had something different than Hendrix, and it's just a feel, and
yeah.
His sound is actually so clean. Again, guitar players use too much distortion. All I hear is distorted guitar sounds. Now, Robert Fripp is different because he uses that in a very... It creates a sound that's only him.
It's a soundscape ambient type
that's
thing,
right.
Yeah, I get that.
You know? But this, it is as clean as a whistle, really. You know, there's a little bit of grit there, but it's got gravitas. It's got power. Every note meant something. And, you know, he plays with such strident notes and it's just incredible. Da-da-dong. It's dramatic. You know, and he pulls off so quick. You know, it's slightly rushed.
Yeah.
You know, but amazing. And that's why he was different. And what he did, he changed the game for all the blues guitar players over there, because everyone wants to start playing like him then, you know. And now, you know, all you see on YouTube is people, you know, trying to play like Stevie Ray Vaughan, which is... Okay, but...
Not a bad thing.
No.
Oh.
he played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the Spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band. Ziggy really sang, screwed up eyes and screwed down hairdo, like some cat from Japan. He could lick 'em by smiling, he could leave 'em to hang. They came on so loaded, man, well hung in snow white tan. Time, jiving us that we were voodoo. The kids were just crass. He was the Nas with God-given ass. He took it all too far, but boy, could he play guitar. Making love with his ego, Ziggy sucked up in his mind, like a leper messiah. When the kids had killed a man, I had to break up the band.
David Bowie, Ziggy Stardust, from his fifth studio album, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, released on the 16th of June 1972 on the RCA record label, recorded at Trident Studios, produced by David Bowie and Ken Scott, and probably one of the greatest riffs in rock and roll history, even though the guitar at the beginning is slightly out of tune.
Perfectly imperfect.
Yes, indeed. Wow. Boom, what a great... You know, what a great sound.
Kick-ass, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, backed off Wild Wild Peddlers, we talked about before, Ronson, you know, a straight rock and roll track, just amazing.
Well, we've talked so much about Rono, I think we don't need to do any more, we just love him, think he's fantastic. I found out as well that his wife, Suzanne, was the one that cut Bowie's hair and dyed it orange, and she gave him the Ziggy cup.
No.
Yep. And also, I didn't realise that, but Ziggy Stardust was not actually conceived as a concept album, and the much of the storyline was written after they recorded the album.
No.
Yeah, it was a bit of a PR stint.
Blimey.
Cool, eh?
You will be queen. lovers. That is that. For nothing will keep us together. We could steal time just for one day. And swing. Though nothing, nothing will keep us together. We can beat them forever and ever. Oh, we can be heroes just for one day.
David Bowie and Heroes, the title track from his 12th studio album released on the 14th of October, way back in 1977 on RCA Records.
It always makes me cry with its beauty, that song. The production is magnificent. Visconti is at his very, very best. And I'm indulging myself once more in Dennis Davis and George Murray on rhythm section, Carlos Alomar, Robert Fripp. Where would that track be without that? Because Robert Fripp, he used Brian Eno's synth, didn't he? Went into his synth to actually create that huge sustaining sound. But the choice of notes, and you walk around the studio to get different feedback, apparently.
Yeah, he did.
From that synth, absolutely unbelievable. Synthy, it was called, like a briefcase thing.
With a joystick or something, is like, crazy. I mean, I feel a bit, I can't talk.
Well, the vocal technique, just talk to me about Visconti's vocal technique on that, because I know we're talking about guitar players.
Yeah, but he used this multi-latch system, which he devised, which is basically, he had three mics he used to capture the vocals. So David stood still and he had one mic 9 inches away, the next one 20 foot away, the next 50 feet away. And when one mic stopped after a few, say a minute, the next one opened up and closed the one down closest to him. So he had to sing louder, and it grew in intensity. So the actual passion and the emotion of the whole vocal take just grew and grew and grew, because he could sing louder, and it was just stunning. You can feel the energy in it.
Well, you can also hear the room reverb taking over, as he's going further and further away. And that was recorded at the incredible Hansa Studios. Now, if you haven't seen the film Studio by the Wall, is it called Hansa Studio by the Wall? Yeah. You must. It's a must watch.
Well, and I didn't realise this as well, that David Bowie sang it at the German Reichstag in West Berlin in 1987. And then when he did, when he passed away, the German government actually said, "Thanks for helping bring down the wall. You are now among heroes."
Wow.
But it's maybe a bit
That's
emotional.
Incredible.
Isn't that just so beautiful? And he wrote it because he saw Tony Visconti hugging his lover by the wall, and he wrote a story about somebody from the east and somebody from the west of Germany.
Yeah, in that documentary, it talks about looking out the window and stuff, you know.
Well, Bowie said, "I'm a person who can take on the guises of people I meet." He's a collector and he collects personalities and ideas. But the fact that he wanted to go on further than all of his influences and combine the lot was because I think he wanted to change music, because he felt a bit boring. And back in 2003, just to conclude this beautiful series that we've had the last two shows of the Supertone Show, he said in an interview in Sound on Sound, "I feel that reality has become an abstract for so many people over the last 20 years. Things that have been regarded as truth seem to have just melted away. And it's almost as if we're thinking..."